Mr. Clark, I think that Streamliners Plan 4, Scale Down and Diversify is the perfect choice.
Well, I will say this. It's the one that sounds the most like what this company should look like.
You're right. It's sleek and efficient. It's also the main choice of other mid-sized service-oriented companies, including Neutral Basics over there on North Broadway. You know them?
Oh, sure. I hear their ads all the time on the oldies station. What they got? They have those, where? Paradise? Who? Me? You know those ads? I love that. La da 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 da. Where? Paradise? Who? Me? I'm sorry if you'll pardon my voice.
No. You've got a great voice. I mean, if I were in advertising, I'd put you on the radio with a catchy jingle.
Yeah, well, the world is lucky that you're not in advertising.
Thanks. Well, the thing I like best about Scale Down and Diversify is that the new training sessions will bring together people who haven't had much contact in a pleasant, low-pressure situation.
Yeah, I might attend some of those myself.
Oh, I bet the people would love that. Plus, the other thing is that the supplier I'd suggest, Extensor, has a new line that combines state-of-the-art office functionality with truly gorgeous design elements, some of them based on actual upper-end automobile designs. I mean, your people will feel like they're working in a Lexus showroom.
Now, that is a car. I mean, we've actually been talking about getting one, you know, trading in our Acura. I mean, it's almost 3 years old now.
That's a good example of how to approach a socializer like Mr. Clark at the collaborating stage of the sales process. The socializer will want your presentation, as well as the product, to look, sound, and feel great. So your polish and grace will probably count for more with the socializer than with the other styles. Socializers also respond well to others' positive experiences. So if you can, back up your claims with testimonials from well-known people or prestigious firms. Your presentation and your product should also focus on how the socializer's prestige, image, or recognition will grow. You can talk about work relationships becoming more enjoyable and how the prospect will score points with minimal added effort. Let's go back to the scene with Josh. He's now at the collaborating stage with his client, Mr. Cummings, whose style is predominantly that of a thinker.
Mr. Cummings, I think that Streamliner's Plan 4, Scale Down and Diversify, is the perfect choice.
Why?
Well, six reasons for starters. One, redrafting and simplifying policies will improve communication on the absenteeism issue. Two, cross-training will help with coverage when absenteeism is unavoidable. Three, the minor cost-effective decorative changes will minimize the 3 o'clock slack effect we've noticed.
You know, I'm not particularly interested in aesthetic or superficial solutions.
Neither am I. I know it's only decor, but the studies are irrefutable. It works. And like I say, the cost is minimal. Now, in terms of dollars invested and productive hours gained, decor is actually the most cost-effective of the six, if only it dealt with all of the pertinent issues.
What is number four?
Four. Extensor's filing series will make each secretarial station and all document storage areas both smaller and roomier. It's just a matter of space usage versus space perception. It fits better. It makes the space feel bigger. And you'll reap somewhere between 50 and 70 square feet of usable space, perhaps for that new customer liaison position that you suggested and that I think you're going to need.
You think so?
Yes. The number of calls and the number of man hours more than confirms the sense you had. And that brings me to five and six. Before I explain the plan elements and benefits, I'd like you to look at these charts.
I think you can clearly hear how Josh customized this stage of the process for a thinker. With a thinker, you emphasize logic, value, quality, and reliability. Thinkers pride themselves on the accuracy of their analyses, so present your product in a way that shows they'll be correct in making the purchase. Base that claim on facts, specifications, and other data. For example, point out the reliability figures, tax advantages, or statistics on increased efficiency. And when you talk about prices, relate them to a specific cost-benefit analysis. Thinkers are very cost-conscious, so use hard facts to show that the expense will be well worth it. And don't forget that thinkers are the most likely of the four behavioral styles to see the drawbacks. So you'll probably score points if you openly discuss your product's obvious disadvantages. If you don't, thinkers may discover them on their own and see that omission as a cover-up. Finally, make your points clearly, then ask if further clarification is needed. It probably will be. Let's hear now how Jennifer and Ms. Carter, the relator, get along at the collaborating stage.
Ms. Carter, I think that Streamliner's Plan 4, Scale Down and Diversify, is the perfect choice.
Really?
Definitely. In a way, it will simply take all the elements that you already have in place and simply, and subtly, manipulate them to work in your favor.
What does it involve?
It involves a combination of training, a redrafting of policy statements, and improving the workspace to, in general, make this a much more pleasant and efficient operation. I have the particular components all in writing here. Many of the things that we've already talked about just put into a more formal system.
Good. What will you need from us?
Oh, you've really been helpful throughout the process. For Plan 4, we'll probably want to go in stages, first dealing with some of the cross-training, and then after some of the design and office furnishing changes. Does that make sense to you?
Yes. Sometimes I think people get nervous if they see too much change going on around them at once. I'm not interested in a major overhaul.
I agree. That would be disruptive. This plan should be fairly simple, but you might want to think about how you'd like to inform the staff of what's going to be happening over the next coming months.
Yes, I think I will.
And if there's any way I can help you with that, generating materials or whatever, please let me know.
You can hear that all these salespeople are basically selling the same product to these clients, but in dramatically different ways. Jennifer showed her client how her product will stabilize, simplify, and support the company's way of doing things. And she was careful to present all changes in a non-threatening way. With a relator, you probably need to spend less time explaining the features, unless the features make life easier, and more time involving relators in your presentation by asking for feedback and answering questions. Relators like to know the appropriate steps to follow, so spell those out. Ask them how they feel about what you're recommending. And make the point that the real benefit in the final analysis is that everything will run more smoothly. Now, let's revisit the scene with Jason and Ms. Crowley, the director.
Ms. Crowley, I think that Streamliner's Plan 4, Scale Down and Diversify, is the perfect choice.
Why perfect?
It will meet the four objectives you've laid out. Decreased absenteeism, better morale, integrated task management, and optimal use of space. The plan addresses each of your needs. In addition, I'd like to show you some evaluation tools you might want to include as well. That will help your manager stay on top of the changes. And there is a paperwork reduction component that, frankly, you don't need, so I'll pull that out and adjust accordingly.
How much is this going to cost?
We'll come in at the low end of the range we discussed, and if we get started within 3 weeks, we should be looking at a 6-week window for us to be in and out completely.
Sounds good. Get copies of this plan and the options to my managers. We'll look it over, and I'll get back to you.
Did you hear how Jason geared his presentation toward the director's priorities? Saving time, getting results, being more efficient, achieving more success. Directors don't evaluate ideas as thoroughly as the thinkers or the relators. They prefer that you do the evaluating, then lay out the options for their approval. Directors like quick, concise analyses of their needs and your solutions. As you do so, skip over less important facts and cut to the bottom line impact. Directors want to be in control, so give them choices backed with just enough data to allow them to make intelligent decisions. Then get out of their way. If you've done your job well in the first three stages, contact, explore, and collaborate, the sale should close itself. It'll flow naturally. That's because top salespeople are always in sync with their customers. They make sure there's agreement every step of the way. So by the time they get to the point of asking for the sale, it's a matter of when, not if. But the ultimate goal is not just closing the sale and implementing the solution. The ultimate goal is gaining a truly committed customer. So the commit stage is critical in building a potential long-term partnership. It requires trust, respect, and open communication on each side. You can't work through all the steps of the sale and then at the end go to a manipulative closing technique to clinch the deal. That doesn't make sense, and it doesn't work. Both of you need the information the other has. If the customer has a concern, it's because she can see something that you can't. So you need to find out what that is, and you need to address it. Traditionally, salespeople are taught to overcome objections as if the sales process were a contest. But savvy salespeople see objections differently. They view them not as rejections, but as mid-course corrections that can steer you toward, not away from, your sales destination. Think of objections as opportunities to make sure that you have the right product matched to the customer's needs. Of course, if you've really done a good job of information gathering since the beginning, if you've kept in step with your customer, and if you've confirmed agreement at each point, there should be few, if any, objections when you come to the commit stage. To best serve your customers and clients, tailor the commit stage to their behavioral style. Let's listen to each of the four scenes as they evolve toward getting the commitment. First with the thinker, then the socializer, then the director, and lastly with the relator.
Mr. Cummings, I know it's a big decision. What exactly are your reservations?
I've looked it all over in detail, and I'm just not sure that it's the right combination of solutions. I think the projections for increased productivity are inflated, and I'm a little leery of some of the backup cases you've shown me. Frankly, they don't figure in some of the factors we have here, some of our market fluctuations and the so-called human factor.
Would you like to see some revisions of the projections?
That might help. Also, all of the decor and office rearrangement ideas. Is that really necessary?
Well, Mr. Cummings, on the surface, it may not translate directly into dollars and cents. But everyone from MIT and RISD to the American Management Association will testify that, well, people are people. They need to feel comfortable, and a workspace does it.
I would love to see more material on that.
Oh, you will. I will also revise the projections to factor in the things that differentiate you from our model cases. I'll get the new proposal to you on Monday and the backup info. If it all looks good, can we count on your commitment?
Well, I'll have to see. But I do want to go ahead with this. So let's say, tentatively, if it all makes sense, yes.
Mr. Clark, I know it's a big decision. What exactly are your reservations?
Well, Jelway, I wouldn't exactly call them reservations. They're more like red lights that go off flashing in my mind saying, Why, is this the number to hit the jackpot? I'll tell you, I've got a cousin in Kansas who has a small restaurant. He tried to do something like this, you know, streamlining, scaling down, make everything neat and tidy. He had someone come in who had some government contracts, which should have been a red light right there. And apparently, they really took him for a ride. I mean, didn't improve anything and ate a ton of barbecued chicken.
Mr. Clark, first of all, I swear on a stack of Bibles that I have never done government work.
Okay.
And secondly, this is not a restaurant. And third, trust me, we know exactly what we're doing. We're the experts. Now, if you have any suggestions about the proposal that will help turn off those red lights, I'd be happy to hear them.
No, Jill, the proposal looks good, and I like you. I really do. I mean, you've got a sense of humor. I like someone who can keep up with me.
Except when they're your competitors, right?
Very good. Very good. All right. All right. Look around.
What?
No red lights.
Does that mean jackpot?
Yeah, jackpot.
Ms. Crowley, I know it's a big decision. What exactly are your reservations?
Well, let me think back on this. What was your proposal?
The revised scale down and diversify.
Oh, yes. I'll be straight with you. I know my company, and I'm not sure you can make it all happen.
What exactly aren't you sure about?
I don't remember the details, but it seems overly ambitious.
Well, you've seen the figures, the basis for the proposals, our track record. I'm not going to convince you of anything. So how about, if we don't make it happen, you don't pay us?
The plan has a guarantee?
Not yet, but I'll put it in. You pay consultation up front. We go ahead with, let's say, two components and set a timetable and criteria for evaluation. If you're not satisfied, you cover our material costs only. If you are, we go full steam ahead. How's that?
You'll do that?
Sure. I'll have to run it past my boss, but I know we can accomplish what we say, so there's no risk involved for me.
I like your commitment.
Great. So, can I get yours to go forward?
You got it. Ms. Carter, I know it's a big decision. What exactly are your reservations?
Well, Jennifer, you've done a wonderful job.
Yes?
I mean, my reservations about the plan have nothing to do with you.
Well, thank you, Ms. Carter. I understand. I've really enjoyed working with you to determine what will be best for your company. So please, tell me what it is that's making you hesitate.
Well, it's a few things. I worry that our employees, well, some of them, will resent the intrusion of outsiders like this. And it could cause a backlash, resisting, not in intentional ways, but resisting nonetheless.
That is a valid concern. You're not the first person who's expressed that concern to me with a proposal of this scope. But I can assure you, we have never had anything of that sort happen. You see, we carefully monitor changes at every step of the process. We truly value communication. Listening to you, listening to your employees, the people who have to live with new procedures or working conditions, and encouraging you to listen to each other. But isn't that really why you brought us in to begin with? You want to make things run even smoother than they already do, both from a dollar point of view and a people point of view?
Well, yes, of course.
I don't want to go ahead with the proposal if you don't feel comfortable. But my sense of you is that you approach a decision like this with a healthy caution, and well, you should. I think we should go back over the proposal, point by point, and look for those elements that might cause even the slightest problem, and then talk about how we can avert, or if necessary, remedy the problem should it arise. Maybe we can do that this week and move my proposed implementation timetable back to next month.
Well, that's not really necessary. I think you're right, that we can deal with problems as they arise, as long as we're on the ball. Look, Jennifer, if you'd like to, I think we can go right ahead and sign the contract.
And sign the contract is what the director and the socializer have done also, along with Ms. Carter, the relator. Mr. Cummings, the thinker, will go ahead with the project too, as soon as Josh gets him the revised projections. Each of these salespeople handled this pivotal point in the sales process with the appropriate strategy from the Platinum Rule. Just to recap, with directors, you can come right out and ask them, are you interested? Say something like, based on the points we've discussed, do you want to subscribe to our service? Usually, they'll give you an answer in no uncertain terms. If they do commit, write a short letter to them explaining your commitment to seeing that results are achieved and pledging your help in attaining their goals. In gaining commitment from socializers, you can ask an open question with direction, such as, where do we go from here, or what's our next step? Socializers are spontaneous. They respond well to the bandwagon approach of, everybody's doing it, or, this offer is going to expire soon. In fact, they're so excitable that you may have to restrain them because they tend to buy before they're sold, which can create buyer's remorse and problems for you later. They also don't like a lot of paperwork. So if any further forms or changes are necessary, assure them that you'll take care of them yourself and that everything will be handled quickly and painlessly. With relators, getting a commitment may require patience. Relators are much slower, deductive decision makers. Try not to rush them, but do provide gentle, helpful nudges. Sometimes they're too shy to tell you in the commit stage that they need more information because that's not what they think you want to hear. Be alert to that possibility, and if necessary, go back to the collaborate stage and go over the information again. Thinkers are the most likely of all the styles to do comparison shopping. So mention your product's strengths and suggest the thinker compare those strengths to your competitors. Uncomfortable with snap decisions, thinkers often need more information, so give them plenty of time to study the options. Also, be willing to reduce risk for thinkers by giving them a trial run or a special guarantee. And don't forget that thinkers prefer specific measures and time frames for gauging results. Now let's move on to the fifth step of the selling process, the assure stage. This is where many salespeople drop the ball. They stop communicating after the customer has committed. In fact, they virtually disappear, leaving installation, training, and follow-up service to someone else. But for the customer smart salesperson, the real job starts when the customer says yes. Assuring customer satisfaction is indispensable to exceptional sales success. If you make sure the customer's satisfied, you get repeat business as well as referrals. Without those, you'll be continually cold calling, which isn't the easiest path to success. You can solidify your relationship with buyers by first being absolutely clear about their expectations. Ask them, what are the criteria that you'll use in judging the success of this purchase? If you did the earlier steps well, you should already have a pretty good handle on those standards. Monitor your customer satisfaction by staying involved with them. Write them a thank you note. Give them a call to see if the product is performing as expected. And at least once a year, give them an annual checkup, a phone call, a drop by, or a lunch at which you make sure that they're happy. And if they are, ask for referrals. If there are problems with the product or service, see those not as setbacks, but as a chance to show how much you care about your customers. Think long term. All future sales and referrals depend on your ability to reaffirm your commitment to quality and service. As always, you can help by gearing your approach to the individual's personal style. Remember that directors are impatient. If there's a problem and they don't hear from you, they'll jump ship and go to your competitor in nothing flat. So follow-up is crucial. You know that their priority is control. So you should check with directors to make sure that they feel that you've delivered on promised results. Because they don't rely on personal relationships and business, you can't assume that one sale means a lifetime of repeat business. Therefore, if problems do occur, be sure to respond immediately with practical solutions and assure them that they have control of the situation. Socializers are more likely than any of the other styles to regret a purchase. They also may become bored quickly with a new purchase. So you need to remind them that they made the right choice, that other people feel good about their decision. You might also show them new uses for the product or new accessories that will help keep the excitement alive. Give them plenty of service and assistance. Plus, be sure that they're using the product correctly. Socializers who become frustrated due to incorrect usage often return the purchase for a refund. Contact them regularly and meet them face-to-face. An out-of-the-office chat, such as a casual breakfast, lunch, or after-work get-together, can be helpful. In any event, be prepared to spend some time. Socializers love visiting with people, especially in relaxed settings. The payoff is that if they're happy, they'll give you great word-of-mouth advertising. They mingle with a lot of people and are likely to talk up their satisfying purchases. That's why if problems occur with your service or product, you need to give it your personal attention, affirm their position, and be prepared for lots of dialogue. Relators need consistent, predictable, hands-on follow-through. Give them your personal assurances that you'll remain in touch, keep things running smoothly, and be available when needed. Relators will appreciate learning how to blend your new product or service with how they've always done things. So you'll want to set up a simple, practical system for two-way communication that will let both of you monitor progress and deal with any glitches. Be sure to reassure relators if any problems do occur that the foul-up is just a blip on life's radar screen and not a fundamental change in your relationship. Also, relators see themselves as having built a friendship with you. So nurture that relationship with personal attention and offers of in-person visits and phone calls. Since thinkers prefer to operate in a controlled, orderly, and error-free way, you should start by asking them how they'd prefer to organize your ongoing communications. For example, how often would they like to meet? Where? And for how long? Keep in mind their stringent standards for products, services, and people. Make sure that you're clear about their expectations of this new acquisition. When you have your follow-up meetings, focus on what the product accomplished as well as how well it performed. If problems do occur, ask the thinker directly, if you were in my position, what would be a reasonable corrective action? Then deliver on that solution and make sure that you follow through until they're satisfied. Let's listen to our four salespeople give a brief assuring message to their clients.
Hello, Ms. Crowley. It's Jason from Streamliner again. I'm just calling to make sure that everything is going smoothly. I don't want to waste your time, but if anything is less than what you expect, please call me, or have someone call me, and I'll deal with the problem immediately.
Hello, Mr. Cummings. It's Josh from Streamliner again. I just wanted to check in with you about the progress of the project. I hear from my people that the refurbishings are about 90% complete, and they're just waiting on a single shipment that should be arriving within the next 2 days. And personnel is already reporting, very preliminary, of course, but they're seeing decreases in absenteeism. I'd like to hear your observations, problems, questions, suggestions, or any changes we need to make.
Hello, Ms. Carter. It's Jennifer from Streamliner again. I'll be calling regularly, if that's okay, to make sure that everything is going smoothly with implementation of the plan. Please, if there are any questions or problems, don't hesitate to ask or mention them. Also, I'm hearing great reports from our people about the reception they're getting on the new procedures and setup, how well it fits in with what you already have, which is what we knew would happen anyway. I have a busy week, but I'm hoping to be able to stop in and say hello and see the metamorphosis for myself. Is there a time later in the week that would be good for me to come by?
Hello, Mr. Clark. It's Jill from Streamliner again. Don't worry, I'm not trying to sell you anything this time. I'm just calling to make sure that what you bought from me the first time is exactly what you wanted. I hear that it's a regular party down there, and I'm hoping to get over sometime and witness the miracle in process. But, you know, they don't let me out of here very often. So if there's any snags or hitches, any wrenches in the monkey works, well, then that's what I'm here for. So pick up the phone and tell me all about it. And when you become big and famous and your company is on the cover of some business and efficiency magazine, do try and mention us, won't you?
I'm sure he will. You know, treating your customers the way they want to be treated, selling them in the way they want to buy, is a strategy that can change your life. Thousands of salespeople have successfully applied the Platinum Rule. They've experienced dramatic increases in sales volumes, as well as greater awareness of their own personal strengths and weaknesses. You might want to follow the lead of one Illinois salesman. He reported a boost in sales when, after studying the Platinum Rule, he drafted 4 different follow-up letters, one for each of the 4 different personal styles he contacts. Or, you can even use your knowledge of behavioral styles as a guiding principle in how you organize your office. An insurance agent in charge of a smaller New England operation began using the Platinum Rule concept to recruit other agents, to show them how to maximize their strengths, and to teach them how to sell better. Within 3 years, his office became the largest in his company and the single biggest insurance agency in the region. What I've described may be a fundamental change in the way you've been selling. If you begin following the Platinum Rule, you may, in effect, be changing jobs. You may be changing from a person who sells things, who sees sales as a one-shot event, who sees a customer merely as a means to an end, to a person who consults and solves problems based on your knowledge of your customer's personal needs and desires. As you work at developing a win-win solution with everyone, you'll find there's a side benefit. Not only will your business improve, but you'll also make many new friends along the way. You'll be building lifetime loyalty to your product or service and to yourself as well. In the final segment of this program, I'll help you discover how you can take your knowledge of the Platinum Rule and apply it to other parts of your life. Over the years I've been teaching these principles, I've heard so many wonderful stories about how people have used them to improve their relationships with family members, students, teachers, and with friends and colleagues of all kinds. I want to share some of those with you. I'll also share a personal story of how I applied the Platinum Rule effectively in a situation involving my wife. We'll have some laughs. And I'll give you a shorthand way of remembering the principles of the Platinum Rule now that you've taken the time to learn them carefully. So join me in the final session.
Back in 1988, I gave a speech at the Million Dollar Roundtable. You know what the Million Dollar Roundtable is? Life insurance, right? The biggest event in the insurance industry worldwide, once a year. So I gave a speech in the summer, June of 1988. 6 months later, in December, I'm speaking for an insurance company. And it is right before, it's at break, right before I'm going to speak after break. And I'm at the coffee table getting coffee and a piece of Danish. And a guy comes up to me, just shy of 60 years old. And he looks at me and he said, "Are you the guy that was at the Million Dollar Roundtable talking about the personality styles?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "I don't believe this. You're going to speak to us?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Wait here." And he runs away. Well, I was going to stay right near the Danish. I wasn't going to move anyway. He comes back with his wife. And takes his wife up to me and says, "Honey, this is Tony Alessandra. He's our speaker today." And she said, "Hi, how you doing?" She was very outgoing and bubbly. "Hi, nice meeting you." He said, No. "This is the guy that spoke at the Million Dollar Roundtable on the personality styles." And she burst out crying. Now, I didn't think the talk was that bad. But she is crying. She is sobbing, heaving. And she comes and she's hugging me as she's crying. She eventually pulls away. My jacket's all wet. She said, I guess I owe you an explanation. My husband and I have been married just a little bit more than 30 years. And we realized that we didn't like each other. For most of the 30 years, our kids lived with us. And the kids tended to be a distraction away from each other. And fairly recently, our last child moved out. And as a result, now we only had each other to deal with. And in dealing with each other with no other distractions, we realized that we did not get along. We rubbed each other the wrong way. And it was so uncomfortable, we decided mutually, now that the kids were grown and out, to get a divorce after 30 years. It was a very difficult decision. And it just so happened that my husband qualified for the Million Dollar Roundtable, incredible honor in the insurance industry. So we decided to hold off filing the papers until after he got back. Well, he went to the Million Dollar Roundtable. She said, "You were one of the speakers." They videotaped it, and they were allowed to buy the videotape just of the talk, and he takes it back home, and he says to his wife, "I heard the speaker, and I think I see what some of our major problems are. Not all of them, but some of the significant ones." He said, "Look, how about if we just sit down and watch this video and talk about it and see if there is a potential solution that we can work on, and maybe we will forego filing the papers for 90 days. They watched it. They talked about it. They definitely saw what each one did to irritate the other. Are there little things that you do that rubs your spouse the wrong way? Or maybe it's the opposite. Are there things your spouse does that bothers you?" It happens in just about every single marriage. Little things. Just little things. So anyway, they talked about this and decided that there was enough to work on for 90 days. And after 90 days, they decided to extend it another 90 days. Now, this was the second 90-day period. And they said it really has worked. They get along a lot better. They have decided, at least for the foreseeable future, not to file for divorce, that they're really starting to learn to like each other and be able to live with each other more comfortably. But when they walked away, two people, 30-plus years married, almost 60 years old, you should have seen them. They were hugging, they were squeezing, they were kissing, they were pinching, they were groping. It was worse than two teenagers at a drive-in movie. But the point is, the concept works in every environment, whether it's with your spouse, whether it's with your siblings, whether it's with your children, whether it's with your customers. What you need to do to master this concept is open your eyes and ears. Pick up the signals that people send.
I love to tell that story because it's such a wonderful example of how the Platinum Rule has been applied outside the workplace. The truth is, we commonly show a different style at work than we do at home. Why? Because it's a sad and ironic fact of human nature that we're more adaptable with the people we know less and less adaptable with the people we know more, especially loved ones. I think the reason has to do with the fact that at work, we're always on exhibit. Someone is watching us and keeping score with our economic well-being hanging in the balance. So there's motivation to get along with as many people as possible. At home, our loved ones already know our warts, and we know theirs. There's no sense hiding them, or so we think. So we probably act more nearly our true selves without giving as much thought to adapting. This, of course, invites tension and conflict. But as my story indicates, knowledge and use of the Platinum Rule can go a long way toward healing those family conflicts. Let me share an example from my own life.
My wife is indirect. I'm direct. She comes home one day from one of those art shows in the park. You know what I'm talking about? The Sunday afternoon art show. She comes back with 7 pictures, all framed. And in my easygoing, direct way, I said, what are we going to do with all this? She said, we're going to put it up in the living room. I said, where? Now, she knows that's just my style, right? She said, well, let me show you. She's so easygoing, it's absolutely incredible. She said, I want to put 2 here, 1 there, 1 there, 1 there, 2 there. I said, okay. She said, I'll be right back. I have to go get something. She left. She came back 10 minutes later, and boy, I am like this. I said, Sue, got all 7 up. See, my goal was to get them all up in 7 minutes. I took 10 off my goal, but she said, what did you do? I said, I put them up just where you wanted. 2 there, 1 there, 1 there, 1 there, 2 there. She said, it's all wrong. Little did I know, she went to go get the tape measure and the level. But we had to redo it. Took 4 hours to redo. Because it had to be just right. For me, hey, it's good enough. Now, was it better? Yeah, it was. I'll agree. I'll admit it. It was better. Was it 3 hours and 50 minutes better? I don't think so. I don't think so. You know, even the good enough, just right, we had a little difference of opinion over one of the paintings if it was level. I said, I guarantee that is as level as it gets. She said, I guarantee it's not. I said, you want to bet on it? She said, yeah. So we made a small wager. She takes the level, goes over, and puts it on the top of the painting. Now, you know those levels. At the very center, they have the 2 little marks and the bubble that has to be in between those 2 marks, right? So she puts this on, and the bubble is in the center just slightly, ever so slightly, touching one of the inside lines in the center. I had a big smile. She said, you lose. I said, who's going to know? How many of our friends come over, pull out a level, and measure? Who's going to know? She said, I will. She won.
Putting up pictures with someone is a great way to test compatibility. Fortunately, my wife Sue and I recognize that we have different styles, very different styles of approaching that kind of task, and each of us is ready to be flexible, to adapt to the other person's style. My style tends more toward faster pace, getting up those pictures fast, and my priority is getting them up. Sue's pace is slower, more methodical, and her priority is getting them exactly the way she wants them. I've also learned, sometimes the hard way, how to apply the Platinum Rule to relationships with my children. Dealing with children can be difficult at best, but using the Platinum Rule can help us parents see how children aren't usually going out of their way to be devilish or ornery. Instead, they're acting, just as adults do, in ways intended to fill the needs of their personality. You can use the same techniques to adapt to your child's behavior as we've outlined for use with adults. Let's take a look at how you might discern the likely personal style of your children and thus what behavior you might expect. If yours is a director child, that'll probably be clear at a very early age. Dealing with a young director is not a walk in the park. They'll show telltale signs early that they're self-contained and interested more in results than in plain socializing. One mother I know heard from the preschool that as early as age 3, her director daughter seemed obsessed with running the fastest, singing the loudest, drawing the best, and otherwise proving herself superior to her peers. Another mom I know noticed that even as a toddler, her son seldom responded to overtures from strangers. Instead, he largely ignored them or looked at them as if they were merely interrupting his work with blocks or toy soldiers or whatever. By age 4, he was demanding flashcards at bath time. Soon, he was showing himself to be quite capable of occupying himself for many hours with puzzles, sports, video games, and other tasks. Another sure sign of a young director is the quickness with which they shed shyness and seek out what they need. They'll learn to quickly go to a security guard, or a teacher or a clerk or other adult if they want help in locating something, whether it be a missing parent, an elusive fact, or a hard-to-find toy in the store. When they don't get their way, director children sometimes try to take charge of the situation by throwing a tantrum or holding their breath or even refusing to eat. As a result, some director children are described as headstrong, difficult, or demanding. But rather than just labeling them, the parent needs to affirm the child's natural need for control over his or her environment. That kind of understanding can produce surprising benefits. Allowing the young director to have authority over pets, toys, or their own rooms, for example, may help channel this need in a very positive way. Otherwise, they'll probably just try to exert control over their brothers and sisters, which may only add to family tensions. What about kids who are born socializers? They may get reprimanded at school for talking, but for them, talking about any experience, good or bad, is as natural as breathing and almost as hard to curtail. Of the 4 types, socializer children respond the most positively to treats and rewards when they're finished with their chores or gotten good grades, practiced the piano, or otherwise performed well. Anything that smacks of potential stardom, plays, recitals, pageants, sports, even cracking jokes, attracts them irresistibly because it fulfills their need for special attention. Solitary activities usually bore them unless they can see these as games. Unlike director kids, the young socializer usually responds enthusiastically to anyone's and everyone's interest in them. They can be precocious flirters and schmoozers who know few strangers, only potential friends and allies. As a parent, you can best help your socializer children by gently reminding them that no one can realistically please everybody all the time, and that popularity, while fun and desirable, is not the sole measure of worth. You might steer them towards some low-keyed altruistic activities. Having your socializer child mow the lawn of the widow down the street, for example, or volunteer to pick up litter at the park might be a welcome antidote to the social whirl that's often at the center of their young lives. Now, if you're one of those lucky parents who said, "That kid has never given me a moment's trouble," then congratulations. You're probably the proud parent of a relator. These are the kids who usually ask for permission before touching the antique vase, who seek your okay before switching TV channels, who say thank you to their aunt without having to be prodded. They nap when they're supposed to, and they may even do their homework without being threatened. All in all, they're pretty endearing. Of course, there's trade-offs. When admiring onlookers compliment your relator child, he or she may smile, but also blush and look at the ground. And trying to get them to sing that cute song or recount the high points of the family vacation for adoring relatives may be as hard as pulling teeth. It's not that the young relators don't like attention, but they prefer, you might say, a seat in the audience to playing the starring role. They're not overachievers by nature, so you may need to coax them to make friends, for instance, when you move to a new neighborhood. And you'll likely need to lean on them a bit to get them to run for the student council or give a speech at school. To stretch, they're probably going to need your help. So as time goes by, you'll want to give them plenty of praise and encourage them to assert themselves a bit more. They want to be on the team, but you may have to nudge them to make sure they attend the tryout. And lastly, there are the thinker kids who often seem more serious than their peers and more addicted to organization. They may stack their toys, compile lists of all the books they've read, keep the puzzle pieces neatly in the box, and generally show a concern for order. One 12-year-old thinker I know writes down everything she'll need to take on a family vacation. One year, she even created a second list with color coding to indicate what outfit she planned to wear on which days. Like the relators, thinker children enjoy watching and observing. But thinker kids usually keep their emotions to themselves. They often do well in school because they're naturally compliant and therefore not as likely to openly question the teacher or the rules. In fact, of all the types, these are the kids who wouldn't want to be embarrassed by not meeting commonly accepted standards, let alone failing to meet their own high expectations. You can help your thinker children by understanding their need for order and personal space. Recognize their sensitive nature and make it a point not to crowd them. You can also spur their growth by ensuring an especially comforting environment, heavy on love and assurance, so that they'll be encouraged to emerge further from their shell. As I said earlier, it's often easier to adapt your behavior at work with supervisors and colleagues than at home with your spouse and your children. Let me give you a little more insight on how to go about cultivating adaptability in all areas of your life. There's two parts to being adaptable, being willing and being able. I call being willing flexibility, which means you're open to the possibility of adapting. You've got a positive attitude about adjusting your behavior in a given situation. This is a sign of maturity. Studies show that highly flexible people tend to be confident. Now, that is, they have trust in their judgments. They're also tolerant. That is, they don't tend to judge opinions or practices that are different from their own. And they're empathic, which means that they relate to what others are feeling. Flexible people are positive about other people, situations, and life, and they're respectful, which means they understand, accept, and appreciate others. If you want to be more flexible, those are the traits that you should cultivate. Again, confidence, tolerance, empathy, positiveness, and respect for others. Conversely, inflexible people are often rigid, overly competitive, discontent, and unapproachable. They also tend to see the world in terms of black and white instead of shades of gray. In other words, they have difficulty dealing with ambiguity. Flexibility has to do with your attitude. On the other hand, versatility is the aptitude for adapting. Since this is not an attitude, but a skill, it takes time to acquire. According to my colleague, Dr. Michael O'Connor, there are certain characteristics that promote this skill. The first is resilience. That's the emotional strength to rebound from setbacks and overcome barriers. Then there is vision, which is the ability to foresee opportunities and create alternatives. A third characteristic of versatility is attentiveness. This is the awareness of people's feelings and having a good sense of timing about your own actions. A fourth characteristic is competence. That means you have the ability to solve problems with a can-do attitude and good follow-up. And lastly, self-correction, which is the ability to clearly evaluate your behavior and learn from your mistakes. Those five characteristics are the traits that we can sharpen to become more versatile. Again, they are resilience, vision, attentiveness, competence, and self-correction. Some qualities, on the other hand, seem to prevent people from being effective at versatility. Those include bluntness, resistance to change, single-mindedness, unreasonable risk-taking, and subjectivity, which is the inability to see the world from any perspective but your own. If these qualities hit close to home, you may want to try to reduce or eliminate them so they don't get in the way of your versatility. Now more than ever, there's an emphasis on the value of collaboration, cooperation, and interdependent networks of people. Who would have ever thought that arch rivals IBM and Apple Computer would ever collaborate? But they have. They began to see the value of collaboration, at least to the point of being able to work on a few joint projects. More and more companies are seeing the value of breaking up departments that used to compete against each other. Instead, they're putting people into teams with shared leadership and a mandate to cooperate with each other. As those companies move from a hierarchical structure to one that's team-based, you hear the same lament over and over. Some of the people who've been around here for a while can't seem to make the transition. They're too set in their ways. They have too much of the old command and control style in their veins. If you suspect that you may have an underlying layer of rigidity in your personality that prevents you from being flexible where flexibility would be an asset, here's some tips. First and foremost, concentrate on listening to what others have to say. Not just passive listening, that is, hearing the words, but learn what's known as active listening, where you do more than simply pay attention. Active listening means that you suspend your judgments about what the other person is saying while you listen. It also means that you're so clear about what the other person is saying that you could paraphrase it back to them and they would agree that that's what they said. Being willing to listen without making judgments takes work. You can tell that you're not doing it when little thoughts like, "That's crazy," or "She doesn't know what she's talking about," when those thoughts pop into your head as you listen. But if you're able to actively listen first and then decide how you feel about something, much more information and new insight will filter into your brain. That's because the rigid guard at the door of your mind has been asked to take a break. Another way to cultivate adaptability is to admit a mistake when you've made one. That's so easy to say and so hard to do. Start by admitting it to yourself. "Darn it, I made a mistake." That's the first step. Some rigid people can't even do that much. The next step is to say it out loud to someone who's affected by that mistake. "Sorry, but it looks like I've made a mistake here." And one more tip. Remember that in many things, the process is as important as the goal. How you arrive at a result in a work project or on a community committee or in your family affects everyone involved. And the process has a direct impact on the success of the next undertaking. Now, I'm not just saying that applying the platinum rule is a piece of cake once you understand the principles. There are difficult situations and difficult people who will really test your adaptability. But your ability to be adaptable, to let go of rigid expectations, to allow for disagreements, are all measures of your maturity in those situations. Being the best person that you can be by treating people the way they want to be treated pays off enormously. And not just by making a sale or scoring points in a social situation. Rather, the big dividend comes in creating a web of rich relationships that make for a fuller life. A recent study in the Journal of the American Medical Association, for example, reported that physicians who have never been sued were more likely to be seen by their patients as concerned, accessible, and willing to answer questions. Conversely, doctors were more likely to be sued if their patients felt they were arrogant, rude, and rushing the visits. The latter group of doctors, in other words, were showing less adaptability, and they paid for it literally. The value of adaptability cannot be overstated. It's the key to the platinum rule, and also the key to building successful relationships of all kinds. Adaptable people realize there's a difference between who they are and their behavior, or how they choose to act. Adaptable people consciously decide how to respond to a person or to a situation or event. Less adaptable people, on the other hand, behave in a more habitual manner, regardless of whether the response is likely to be appropriate or effective. They're sort of like mules, plodding along by putting down one foot after another without much thought. Mules are good for some things, of course, but they're not known for adapting their behavior to fit the circumstances. That's why they've come to symbolize stubborn resistance. But even if you're a mule, even if you're a person who's been wedded to your own ways of thinking and doing for a very long time, there is hope. You can commit to learn to be more flexible and versatile. Reducing your rigid behavior will make you more successful in your dealings with everyone, from the checkout clerk at the grocery store to the company president, not to mention your spouse and your children. Besides, by now you're already more than halfway there. You know your own behavioral style or combination of styles. You know the other styles and how to identify them. You've got a pretty good idea about what you need to do to adapt to others. But you still may find it difficult to actually implement the changes. You can't expect to change a lifetime's habit patterns overnight. But you can begin to change if you're really committed. If you're not confident yet about your ability to identify the four behavioral styles, listen to this program again, especially the sections that ask you to practice identification skills. Listen to them a third time if necessary. Then consciously try to apply the principles as you go through your day. It's really a small investment of time and energy for a big return of improved relationships in your life. As with any skill, you'll find that your ability improves with practice and repetition. Then you'll be able to spot the subtle yet telltale behaviors of each of the four styles. I covered a lot of strategies for dealing with the four styles, and now I'd like to boil those approaches down to one word. When you're dealing with each of these styles, whether you're dealing with them personally or professionally, whether it's communicating, managing, motivating, leading, counseling, correcting, selling, servicing, it doesn't matter. If you're dealing with a relator and you want to draw them closer to you, you want to develop better rapport. You want them to put a positive spin on everything you say as opposed to a negative spin. Whatever you do with relators, all I ask you to do is to do it friendly, with warmth, with feeling, with sensitivity. With thinkers, whatever you do, do it precisely and accurately. My rule of thumb for dealing with thinkers, make sure your approach is well planned, well structured, well documented. With directors, whatever you do, just do it and get out. Bottom line, cut to the chase, no nonsense. And with socializers, whatever you do, make it fun, exciting, surprising, unpredictable.
Let me end with one story to drive all this home. Many years ago, in the days of King Arthur, four knights allegedly committed a very serious crime, and as a result, they were put on trial. Now, during the trial, these four knights vehemently protested their innocence, but it didn't do any good whatsoever. They were still convicted, sentenced to death by none other than the guillotine. On that fateful day of execution, a special guillotine was built with four slots so all four knights could be beheaded simultaneously. On that fateful day of execution, the four knights were led up onto the platform and knelt down, one head went in each of the four slots. The Royal High Executioner came up with his axe, and upon word from King Arthur, he took the axe, cut the rope, and the blade from the guillotine went 2 inches before it touched any of their necks. The blade got stuck. It malfunctioned. Well, that was seen by King Arthur as a sign from above that these knights were innocent. So he pardoned them and set them free. And each knight was ecstatic. Each knight wanted to express his feelings his way. And of course, there was one director, one relator, one socializer, one thinker. First one to be set free is a director. The director got up and in his own way looked at the crowd and said, I told you during the trial I was innocent. You didn't believe me then, now you believe me. And I might add, almost a little too late. I hope the next time I say something, you listen to me when I say it. And Arthur, let me tell you something. I'm suing. The relator goes up to the executioner, takes his hands, and says, Roger, I know this wasn't your fault. I know you were just following orders. I probably would have done the same thing. I just want you to know that I've let the hard feelings go. I'm not going to hold a grudge. In fact, would you join me and my family for dinner this Sunday? Socializer jumped up, looked at everybody, and simply said, let's party! Oh, last one up. Last one up. The thinker, as the thinker got up, he looked up at the guillotine and said, hey, hey, I see the problem.
Thank you for listening. I hope this program has provided you with much information that's valuable to you in improving your relationships with all sorts of people. And if we ever have the opportunity to meet in person, I hope you can tell me a Platinum Rule story about how you were able to apply this material in a situation where it made a big difference in your life. Good luck.